Good evening. We begin tonight with breaking news and perhaps a preview of things yet to come. After trading verbal jabs all day, President Trump and Democratic frontrunner Joe Biden are at dueling live campaign events in Iowa. The president is in West Des Moines at a GOP fundraising dinner. He's just getting started, thanking his host, talking about his 2016 primary victory. Vice President Biden just about 160 miles down Interstate 80 in Davenport. Again, this is after a day of each man slamming the other, neither waiting to get to Iowa. Biden early this morning releasing an advanced copy of his Davenport remarks, describing the president as an existential threat to democracy. The president weighing in a short time later on the South Lawn.
Well, I heard Biden, who's a loser. I mean, look, Joe never got more than 1%, except Obama took him off the trash heap, and now it looks like he's failing. Now, I have to tell you, he's a different guy. He looks different than he used to. He acts different than he used to. He's even slower than he used to be. So I don't know. I think he's the weakest mentally. And I like running against people that are weak mentally. I think Joe is the weakest up here.
That was the president this afternoon, followed by Mr. Biden, by now wheels down in Iowa.
The idea that that I believe, and I didn't believe this, if you had asked me this 5 years ago, I'd have told you you're crazy. I think there's a genuine threat to American democracy. You know, think about this. No president of the United States has ever, since the end of World War II, we built that Atlantic Alliance and NATO, ever threatened to leave NATO. Never gone after our allies, embracing dictators and thugs from Putin to Kim Jong-un, calling them my friend, sending love while he's poking his finger in the eye of our allies. What's going on here? This is really dangerous stuff. He's a threat, in my view, a threat to our core values. And folks, the fact of the matter is that 4 years of Donald Trump will be viewed as an aberration in American history. 8 years will fundamentally change who we are as a nation and how we're viewed around the world.
Again, we're monitoring both live events. And as a backdrop to this all, new nationwide polling from Quinnipiac University showing a 13-point Biden lead over the president, with Senators Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, and Elizabeth Warren also ahead by 9, 8, and 7 points, respectively. Joining us now, two veterans of campaigning in Iowa and nationwide, 2004 presidential candidate, former Democratic National Committee Chairman Howard Dean, also a six-term governor of Vermont, and David Axelrod, senior advisor to President Obama and currently host of the Axe Files here on CNN. So, David, this virtual head-to-head battle today in Iowa, what do you make of it? Because it's certainly the first time these two men are campaigning in the same place at the same time and taking each other on in such a direct way.
Well, I think for Joe Biden, this is an ideal situation. He should send the president a gift for this, because the whole thesis of his campaign is that he is the old warrior coming back to rid the country of this scourge, that he is that this is all about him and Trump. And Trump is affirming that with everything that he does by going after him in such a personal way in his tweets, in his comments. This is Biden's strategy for getting nominated. The Democratic Party, most Democrats are desperate to get rid of Donald Trump by a 2-to-1 margin. They say that is more important to them than ideological kinship. And the theory of the Biden campaign is to run against Trump from the beginning. That's what he's done from his announcement forward. For the president, I think he's looking at these polls like the one you just showed, and he's concerned, and he should be concerned. He was trailing not just Biden, but several other Democrats. But he sees Biden as the front runner right now, and he's not waiting to try and cut him down to size.
Governor Dean, can you imagine President Bush ever taking you on, or one of the other front runners, so directly in the run-up to the primaries in 2003? I mean, at the stage we're at in this race?
No, but Trump, you know, does things his own way. You know, Trump is an unattractive person. I think, you know, I read the whole speech that Joe gave, and I thought it was very good. But that speech is not going to get us to the victory line. He has to say what he's going to do, not just that Trump is an idiot. Everybody who hears Donald Trump, and Donald Trump likes to talk about himself, is reminded why they don't like Donald Trump. Joe doesn't have to do that. He just has to say what he's going to do. What are we going to do about health care? What are we going to do about the economy for all those people who Trump didn't give a tax cut to, which was the vast majority of the American people. So, you know, this is sort of phase one. Trump is not going to rise above this, because he can't rise above anything. Joe Biden was the vice president of the United States. He can. And when we get into this, if he turns out to be the nominee, we want to see him acting presidential, as he's capable of doing it. Trump is not.
David, a reporter from The Washington Post pointed out on Twitter today that both President Trump and Vice President Biden, they seem to be obsessed with how much the other is obsessed with them. Might being obsessed with voters, you know, needs, I mean, to the governor's point, you know, talking about what you're for, what your policies are, and doing it in a way, frankly, I mean, you juxtapose the way President Trump speaks, the way, you know, Vice President Biden speaks. It is certainly, it seems to be whether, I don't know if it's a different energy level. Obviously, the content is different and the approach is different, but it is a very stark juxtaposition.
Yeah, well, you know, I just want to echo what Howard said. I don't think that this is going to be adequate for Biden. The fact is he had a kind of a bad week last week. He mishandled this question of the Hyde Amendment and did kind of a flip-flop flip. And the Iowa poll came out on Saturday night. Howard's familiar with the Iowa poll. And what it showed was that Biden had lost a third of his support since December. Still the front runner, 8 points ahead of Bernie Sanders. But right behind Sanders was Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg. And Biden, the enthusiasm level of Biden's supporters was not as high as that of the others. So he's got his work cut out for him. And I quite agree with Howard. I don't think it's nearly enough to say that he wants to defeat Donald Trump. And I'm not even sure that it's enough that polls show right now that he may have the best chance to do it. He's going to have to show more. This was only his second visit to Iowa since May. And, you know, this is a process. It's not a national primary. It begins in Iowa. And Joe Biden, as the front runner, is obligated to win that primary. If he comes in second or third, the whole thing could unravel. So he's got a lot of work to do.
Well, and Governor Dean, I mean, to be honest, you know, as he has run before, he has never done well in presidential races. So, I mean, a lot of people, a lot of Democrats are sort of looking at him because his name recognition is high and his poll numbers show him to be in the lead. But the history of him running is not a good one.
Well, you're going to hear me say this many times between now and November of 2020. The poll numbers that you showed are really not helpful, because my guess is that they're national poll numbers, and this is 50 separate races, starting with four races, which are Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. Those are the poll numbers we have to have. It doesn't do any good to show Biden 13 points ahead. That could be all California and New York. That doesn't do us any good. We're going to win those states no matter what. So there's a lot more information we need to know before we can start making judgments. I think one of the candidates that nobody's ever heard of is going to catch fire. I don't know who it's going to be, but I think they will.
For a moment, I thought you were going to say who that was, but you're like everybody else. You don't know who that is.
Yeah.
Governor, I want to play something of what the president said about Biden today on the White House lawn.
He's a different guy. He looks different than he used to. He acts different than he used to. He's even slower than he used to be. So I don't know. But when he mentions my name that many times, I guess I should be complimented. I like running against people that are weak mentally. I think Joe is the weakest up here. The other ones have much more energy. But but I don't bring them up.
It's so interesting, Governor, and I also want to talk to David about this. The way the president, you know, identifies what he perceives to be weaknesses in his opponents and then sort of throws it out time after time after time, and is already kind of laying the groundwork for, you know, sleepy Joe Biden, low energy, with hints of age. It's clearly a strategy the president has employed before for all his Republican challengers, you know, 2 years ago.
He did employ that before. The problem is people know Donald Trump right now, and the country is unbelievably polarized. So Trump is annoying when he talks like that, but I don't doubt that he moves much in the way of votes. He's got a hardcore minority of about 35% that, as he once famously said, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and they'd be still with me. That may be true. But, you know, Trump is not presidential, and people actually do care about that. One of the great points I thought that Biden made in his speech was, do you want your children to look up to a president that behaves like Donald Trump? And I think most Americans would say absolutely not.
David, do you think what the president is doing, does that work? I mean, implanting the idea of Joe Biden's low energy?
Well, it is a familiar tactic he has, and I've said it before, kind of a feral genius for painting his opponents in a caricature. But the thing that I think is important for Biden is to run an energetic campaign that dispels any of these caricatures. He hasn't had a very heavy campaign schedule. He sort of played into the caricature, and I think he's going to have to come forward, as Howard said, with ideas, and he's going to have to campaign energetically. One of the things about the Iowa caucuses, and Howard Dean knows this as well as anyone, is people expect to see you. Yeah. They want to interact with you. You have to be there, and you can't do drop-bys and use them as a backdrop to attack the president. You've got to do much more than that. So I think that's very important.
It's fascinating. Howard Dean, thank you. David Axelrod as well. Coming up next, as we continue to monitor the two live events, the man who now holds Joe Biden's old Senate seat, Senator Chris Coons, is going to join us. And later, hard to do justice to the power of John Stewart's congressional testimony today on behalf of 9/11 first responders. We'll play a bunch of it for you at length and talk as well with one lawmaker who was actually there.
And in front of me,
we're talking tonight about the primary campaigning in Iowa that President Trump and former Vice President Biden already appear to be treating in general election terms. Both campaigning tonight in Iowa, the president in West Des Moines, Vice President Biden speaking in Davenport, largely campaigning past his primary opponents, attacking the president instead. Here's what he just said.
You know, Donald Trump and I are both in town today. Or in, at least in the state today. Wasn't planned that way, but I hope Trump's presence here is maybe a clarifying moment for us all. American farmers have been crushed by his tariff war with China, and no one knows that better than the folks of Iowa. You know, he thinks that being tough, he's being tough. Well, it's easy to be tough when someone else is feeling the pain and taking the hit.
That was Joe Biden just a few moments ago. Senator Chris Coons, a Democrat of Delaware, joins us now. Senator Coons, what about that? Is Vice President Biden making a mistake by focusing so much on the president? David Axelrod was making the point, and Howard Dean was as well, about needing to be for something and talking about what you actually want to do. He certainly did talk a lot about the president today.
Well, Anderson, Joe Biden has laid out already some strong and concrete and positive policy plans for how he would tackle climate change, how he would address education. Today in Davenport, tonight in Davenport, what he's doing is drawing a very strong contrast between how he would lead as president and how Donald Trump has been misleading our country on his tariff taxes, on his attacks on health care, on his failure to lead on climate. So I do think it's important for former Vice President Biden, to draw a strong contrast with Donald Trump, because that's what most Democratic primary voters say they want, is to understand clearly what Joe Biden would be for, which he has been laying out in detail the last 2 weeks, and how he would beat Donald Trump in the general election campaign, which is exactly what he's speaking to tonight.
You know, one of the things David Axelrod also said was that, Vice President Biden has run so far, he hasn't been out on the campaign as aggressively as no doubt he probably will be. Does that play into what President Trump is trying to do right now, which is, you know, kind of road test nicknames or attacks that might work on Biden? And he seems to be focusing on the idea that he's, that he's not as fast as he once was, that he's slowed down, that he's low energy, which is, of course, what he said about, Jeb Bush.
Well, look, I think it's ridiculous if we play into Donald Trump's hands by repeating the sort of eighth grade bully nicknames that he loves to throw around against his most feared opponents. The reason Joe Biden wasn't in Iowa at the state party function on Friday, it was his daughter's birthday and his granddaughter's high school graduation. And I think the American people know Joe Biden. They know his heart and his values. And they respect the fact that rather than being at an important campaign event in Iowa, he was at an even more important family event at home in Delaware. I frankly would expect the average voter to question Joe's priorities if he had missed his granddaughter's high school graduation in order to be at an event where he was going to speak for just 5 minutes. I think it's important that he has been campaigning vigorously. He's been to each of the critical early primary states already. He's been doing events all over the country. His campaign launch in Philadelphia, I thought, laid out a positive, optimistic, and clear path forward for his candidacy. Mm. And I couldn't disagree more with both the substance and the strategy of Donald Trump of rolling out all these middle school nicknames against his most feared opponent, Joe Biden.
I just want to play something that the vice president said today in Iowa to a crowd. Let's listen.
I promise you, if I'm elected president, you're going to see the single most important thing that changes in America is we're going to cure cancer.
Obviously, cancer is very personal for the vice president. His son, Beau, died in 2015. The vice president spearheaded the cancer, so-called cancer moonshot program for the Obama administration. Promising to cure cancer, though, I mean, it's something that if President Trump said that, I think a lot of people, a lot of Democrats would, you know, maybe go after him for it. Is it appropriate for Vice President Biden to make that promise?
Look, one of the things presidents have done throughout our history is to set ambitious and optimistic goals for the American people. Jack Kennedy said, we will go to the moon, and not because it's easy, but because it's hard. And by lifting our sights to the ambitious goal of landing on the moon and mobilizing our nation in that direction, I think he played a central role in getting it accomplished, not while President Kennedy was still alive, but within just 5 years. So I think, you know, it's important to remember that President Obama entrusted his vice president, Joe Biden, with the so-called cancer moonshot. And I can think of no more ambitious and uplifting goal for him to lay out for us than to make a real dent in this tragic disease that has taken so many loved ones from so many American families, including Joe's own beloved son, Beau.
Yeah. Sir Coons, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anderson.
As we watch both events, it's worth noting the president is about 20 minutes into his speech so far, hasn't mentioned Joe Biden once, although, as we said, talked about him earlier today at the White House. Perspective now on all of it from three top campaign watchers, CNN senior political analyst David Gergen, advisors to Republican and Democratic presidents alike over the years, also former Obama White House communications director Jen Psaki, and Mike Shields, former Republican National Committee chief of staff. David, I mean, on the cancer, you know, again, if President Trump said he, you know, his administration, he promised that if you elect him next term, his administration is going to cure cancer, he would get attacked. Was it, you know, I mean, nobody can promise that.
I agree with that. And I think going to the moon is quite different than trying to cure cancer. You know, we've been working for years and decades and finding cures of cancer. We've made a lot of progress, but the final answers have been really, really elusive. And it's hard to believe we're going to do it in 4 years. He's entitled to say that. I don't think that's his problem, though, Anderson. And I think the Biden people must be encouraged about the Quinnipiac poll in the sense that he's got this 13-point lead currently over Donald Trump. But there is rising concern in Democratic circles about his candidacy, about what, as David Axelrod said, he had a bad week last week, and he came out to give this major address today, and it is a very, very long address. I think Senator Coons who's a good surrogate, would admit that. But what was lacking was something fresh. It's hard to tell what the lead was coming out of a long speech like that. And when that's the case, you know, what you say to people, the rhetoric sort of becomes mushy. And he needs to be clear cut and to have a sense of freshness, not have a sense of that he's still thinking in terms of the 1990s.
Yeah, I mean, Jen, you can knock the president for, you know, the insults, the eighth grade insults and coming up with nicknames and stuff. It's certainly, you know, rightly or wrongly, it sticks in people's minds. And, you know, to David's point, what Joe Biden said today, you know, if you read it, it's one thing, but it was very long and hard to sort of, you know, take some things away.
I think that's right, Anderson. I agree. You know, I think in some ways today was set up in a way that Joe Biden couldn't have asked for something better, and that he was aligned kind of head to head with President Trump. That's part of his message that he's inevitable. That has never really worked for Democrats in the past, and we have a long way to go. His speech had some good moments. I thought his language on climate change and the prepared remarks was good. You know, he talked about it in an accessible way about farmers and droughts, but there was a lot of missed opportunity there. I mean, look, if you look at the recent CNN Des Moines Register poll, issues like abortion rights, issues like guns, those are issues Democratic voters in Iowa really care about. He has a story to tell there, but he can also be forward-looking. And there are events that have happened that he could have touched on. I mean, the defunding of Planned Parenthood sex education by the legislature. So he needs to do a little more that's forward-looking. And I agree, there needs to be a central theme that people can kind of, you know, grasp into.
Yeah, Mike, I mean, watching, you know, the split screen, seeing both both men speak today, are you pleased with the juxtaposition?
Well, look, I think Joe Biden is sort of losing the rationale for his candidacy. And when he gets sucked into a fight with President Trump, he thinks that's the smart thing to do to prove he can go fight him. But really, then all he's doing is talking about President Trump. And I think what's been proven with Joe Biden through three failed presidential campaigns and the horrible week he had last week is that when you put pressure on him, he makes mistakes. And so I think the president's going to keep messing with him and keep trying to suck him into this. And in the meantime, there's an entire Democratic primary electorate that want to hear about issues that the other candidates are talking about. And so Joe Biden is sort of running this. I'm the front runner. Just sort of nominate me because. And I just don't think he's good enough to pull that off. I think he makes a lot of mistakes. When you put, he said Vice President Pence was a decent man. He got criticized for that. He immediately said, no, that's not what I meant to say. He was on the wrong side of an issue like abortion. You put pressure on him, he immediately changes his position on it. So I think we're seeing the real holes in his campaign, and he's getting sucked into a fight with the president. And that's what the president wants to do. And once he's done with Biden, he'll pick the next guy and do the same thing to them.
Yeah, I mean, David, I think Mike makes a great point that, you know, we've all seen the danger of somebody being, you know, allegedly a front runner, because they have name recognition early on, and then there's this sort of inevitability that then people kind of resent, and then nobody can really live up to that.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's one of the reasons to keep an eye on these polls. Ordinarily, at this stage, you'd say, well, there's so many months out, well, they're useless. But if you see a changing dynamic, and there are signs of a changing dynamic, when Biden announced, after his announcement, nationwide in Quinnipiac, he had a 38%, that 38% of Democrats said, I'm for Biden. That number nationwide, New Quinnipiac, is down to 30. And the other candidates are moving up, each one's moving up 2, 3, 4 points. That makes it, Iowa could become a very competitive state.
Yeah.
We don't know. I think what could be working for him, Anderson, in the long run, is if he can maintain 30, if he can maintain 32, with four or five other people, you know, running against him and getting 8%, 6%, you know, he'll emerge as the winner because nobody else can put it together.
Although, Jen, you know, Governor Dean in the last segment pointed out that, you know, that's Quinnipiac, it's a national poll. That could be, those numbers could be California and New York. What matters is Iowa. What matters is New Hampshire, you know, the early states.
That's exactly right. And I've spent a lot of time in Iowa over my career, and people expect, and I know that other guests have brought this up already, that you're going to spend time with them in the state. They want to meet candidates not just once, but twice, but five times. They may want you to sit on their couch. And so I expect when Biden, if he goes and spends more time there, the relatability of Biden, the decency of Biden, that's something that comes across for anybody who spends time with him. But he really needs to go and spend days and days in the state, really, you know, work for every vote, as he said he would. I expect he will, but he needs to do that soon.
Yeah. David Gergen, Jen Psaki, Mike Shields, thank you. Appreciate it. Still to come, President Trump says he has proof of a secret immigration deal with Mexico. It's not that simple, however. More ahead. President Trump has sworn since Sunday that he has a secret immigration deal with Mexico. And today, despite Mexico saying there is no such deal, the president offered what he called proof, a folded letter, when he repeatedly waved at reporters.
That's the agreement that everybody says they don't have through. But here's the agreement. It's a very simple agreement. So here's your thing. You know, they all say, oh, he doesn't. I just give you my word inside here, and I would love to do it. But you will freeze action it. You will stop it. So right here is the agreement. It's very simple. It's right here. And in here is everything you want to talk about it. Like done. It's done. It's done. It's all done.
It's like the Wonka golden ticket. There is actually writing on the letter. According to multiple reports, there's nothing that would constitute proof of a secret deal. CNN Global Affairs analyst and Washington Post columnist Max Boot joins us now. I mean, whatever was or wasn't on the paper, it's certainly so classic President Trump to like drum up a dramatic reveal.
Right.
Whether or not the reveal ever takes place.
Well, here's a rule of thumb, Anderson. If you actually have a secret deal, don't take it out and wave it on international television. That's not what you do with secret deals. But as you say, the writing was actually legible when he held it up, and a Washington Post photographer took a picture of it, which was then enlarged. And basically what it suggests is that, no, there is no secret deal. It was a non-agreement where the Mexican government basically said, if there is not a major reduction in 45 days, we will agree to look at other steps to reduce immigration. So it's basically an agreement to talk some more in 45 days.
Which is essentially this kind of, it fits into how this whole thing has played out. I mean, all the things that the president said resulted because of his threat, a lot of it was worked out long ago.
Yeah, no, this is part of a pattern with Trump where he is both arsonist and firefighter. He creates crises and he claims credit for resolving them, even though he hasn't actually resolved them. I mean, for example, he claimed to have averted war with North Korea, and there wasn't going to be a war with North Korea, but the odds of one had actually increased because it was fiery rhetoric. And now, of course, he claims that there was going to be all these terrorists, which would have been an economic crisis with Mexico. And lo and behold, 72 hours beforehand, there's this great deal that he's negotiated that will end illegal immigration, except it won't actually end illegal immigration. And most of it was already negotiated months before. So it's a complete non-deal.
Well, also, you wonder what sort of, you know, foreign governments think of this. I mean, the president literally showed his hand today. I mean, if you are making a deal, yes. It just seems an odd way to go about diplomacy.
Well, the whole thing is just shows why, you know, no foreign government can take Donald Trump seriously, even though sometimes they have to deal with him because he can do actual bad things to them. They can't take him seriously as a negotiating partner because, remember, there was actually an agreement that he trumpeted the USMCA to replace NAFTA, which was supposed to be a much better free trade agreement with Mexico and Canada. And then he ignored the terms of that agreement by threatening these massive tariffs with Mexico. The Mexicans negotiated with him. And of course, they didn't make any real concessions. He claims that they did. But, you know, this is kind of a pattern with him where he will create these crises and then pretend to resolve them, even though he hasn't really resolved them. And I think what foreign governments are saying is this guy is a bluffer. He is a very bad poker player. He is so eager for a victory tweet that he will issue a victory tweet, even though there's no actual victory to herald.
Well, he also talked about Kim Jong-un today. Again, his appreciation for a murderous dictator is pretty extraordinary. I mean, talks about a beautiful letter, right, about not, you know, letting the CIA, you know, not have anybody spy on him.
Yeah,
it's kind of remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, Trump lives in this bizarre world where he treats our friends as if they were enemies and treats our enemies as if they were friends. And, you know, he's blustering against Mexico, which is one of our closest allies and trade partners. And he's saying that he has a beautiful relationship with Kim Jong-un. And, you know, he doesn't have anything bad to say about the fact that his buddy in Pyongyang, with whom he's supposedly in love, assassinated his brother using weapons of mass destruction in an international airport. He has not one negative thing to say about that.
Two women putting chemical weapons in the guy's face.
Right. Instead, he's promising Kim Jong-un that he's not going to authorize essentially the CIA to recruit assets who could spy on the leader of North Korea, which is as crazy as you can imagine, because if they had recruited his brother, that would have been a huge victory for the United States.
Max Boot, appreciate it. Thank you.
As
always. Just had John Stewart ripping lawmakers over benefits for 9/11 first responders. Take a look.
Indifference cost these men and women their most valuable commodity, time.
Earlier today, comedian John Stewart appeared before Congress with 9/11 first responders and members of Congress to argue for something that should get more attention in this country, the fund that provides support for the families of those who gave their lives and those who are still giving their lives or their health, is running out of money and must be reauthorized. In his testimony, Stewart pleaded for Congress to make this a top priority.
Behind me, a filled room of 9/11 first responders, and in front of me, a nearly empty Congress. Sick and dying, they brought themselves down here to speak to no one. It's shameful. It's an embarrassment to the country, and it is a stain on this institution. And you should be ashamed of yourselves for those that aren't here, but you won't be. Because accountability doesn't appear to be something that occurs in this chamber. The official FDNY response time to 9/11 was 5 seconds. 5 seconds. That's how long it took for FDNY, for NYPD, for Port Authority, for EMS, to respond to an urgent need from the public. 5 seconds. Hundreds died in an instant. Thousands more poured in to continue to fight for their brothers and sisters. The breathing problem started almost immediately, and they were told they weren't sick, they were crazy. And then, as the illnesses got worse and things became more apparent, well, okay, you're sick, but it's not from the pile. And then when the science became irrefutable, okay, it's the pile. But this is a New York issue. I don't know if we have the money. And I'm sorry if I sound angry and undiplomatic, but I'm angry, and you should be too, and they're all angry as well. Your indifference costs these men and women their most valuable commodity, time. It's the one thing they're running out of. And the idea that you can only give them 5 more years of the VCF because you're not quite sure what's going to happen 5 years from now. Well, I can tell you, I'm pretty sure what's going to happen 5 years from now. More of these men and women are going to get sick and they are going to die.
Well, Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney of New York represents part of Manhattan, was at the witness table today with Stewart and several 9/11 first responders. Representative Maloney, you're clearly a supporter of this bill. You're wearing a fireman's jacket right there. Can you just explain why this funding is even an issue? I mean, shouldn't funding for the health care of first responders be a non-issue?
It should be a non-issue, and John Stewart has every right to be angry, and so am I, but I'm hopeful we will be reporting the bill out of the committee tomorrow. We have over 311 co-sponsors for the bill, which is a large, large number for the House, and over 81 Republicans, so it's strongly bipartisan. I hope that we will pass it on the floor of Congress before the 4th of July, when we celebrate the principles of this country and values of this country, of which the first responders are an example. So I'm hopeful.
So, I mean, do you hear that argument that, oh, this is a New York problem? Why are we focusing on this? I mean, part of the compensation fund, part of why it's running out of money is because medical claims from first responders are on the rise. More people are needing treatment. I mean, these are long-term medical needs that are going to go on.
Yes, particularly cancers. Cancers have grown substantially. A third of the claims now are cancer, and it's a very, very serious problem. It's difficult to pass anything in the House of Representatives, but it also is hard to understand when we can give trillions of dollars in tax breaks and subsidies for crops and other things, which all of which is important, but we should have the money for our first responders. They were there for us. We need to be there for them. And we have a moral responsibility. Not only did they show up and be part of one of the greatest rescue efforts in history, but they were lied to about the health conditions at 9/11. They were told to go back to work, that it was safe to work there, when it wasn't.
So we have
a double moral responsibility to them.
Are claimants' payments already being cut because of the shortfall in funds, or is that just a concern down the road?
The payments are being cut now. We made the health care program permanent back in 2015, but we extended the Victims Compensation Fund for 5 years. That was the best we could do. We are now coming back to reauthorize it. The fund is running out of money, so the special master had to cut allocations by 50% to 70%, depending on when you went into the program. Our bill would restore and make each family whole and provide funding for the families who desperately need it, who have lost their fathers, who have been sick, cannot work. Many of them are dying. Many of them are close friends of John Stewart's. He's been working on this for many years, and for him to see them declining is extremely upsetting to him and many others. They should have their compensation, and we will never give up until they have it.
Congresswoman Maloney, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up next, new legal pressure by the House on the White House. This afternoon, the House voted along party lines to approve a resolution paving the way for the Judiciary Committee to go to court to enforce a key action, namely the subpoena demanding former White House counsel Don McGahn's testimony. Now, the resolution also authorized the committee to take its subpoena for Attorney General Barr to court. But they won't do that for now after an agreement was reached with the Justice Department on Monday. Chris Cuomo joins me now with more on this and what he's going to be covering at the top of the hour. Hey, Chris, how you doing?
How you doing, Coop? Drip, drip, drip. You know, look, this is the question for the Democrats. What is your duty and how do you do it in the most expeditious and efficacious way? I'm not saying that that's impeachment, but they have to make a decision because you're seeing that the upside to an inquiry is that they're at their maximal powers. They'll get things through the courts arguably faster because that's the tactic being used upon them. This is going to take a very long time. Are they okay with that? They need to decide, tell their constituents, and move forward. Tonight, we have Bill Maher on. We have more from our interview last night. It made a lot of buzz. There was a lot left on the table where he goes into his specialty these days of political prognostication, what he thinks is going to happen, what he's afraid is going to happen. So we have that. And then we have Kim Porter on, you know, one of these, you know, charging young lions within the Democrat Party, the congresswoman from California, Katie Porter, obviously, what she thinks they should do going forward. So Katie Porter is going to be on to answer for the new left. Bill Maher is here for the concerns for the old guard.
All right. It's about 7 minutes from now. Chris, thanks very much. Chris, are you the old guard or are you new guard?
I am definitely old guard. I am the oldest person on my show.
I know. It's depressing when you're no longer the young person in the room. You and I used to be the young people at ABC.
Yeah, but you have looked like this since I met
I've
you.
I've looked ancient, yes, since even when I was young. But nobody says to me, oh, you were prematurely gray. Now they're just like, yeah, you're gray.
I was looking at video of both of us during 9/11 doing the coverage, and your coverage then was brilliant, the stories that you brought at that time. I look like my son. I look nothing like I look today. Totally changed. You look the same except for the glasses, which we all know you don't need.
I wish. If only. If only I could figure out how to put contact lenses in my eyes, which I can't. Though I've had many lessons. All right, Chris, I'll see you soon. Just add a story that just blew me away. So many kids in need in this country. Kids who are homeless, in foster care, kids struggling with life-threatening illnesses. You're going to meet a Colorado teacher who had one student, a 13-year-old boy, dealing with all of those things. And we'll tell you what he did for this little boy. There's obviously a lot of division, polarization in the world today. But from Colorado tonight, I want you to know about this story. A math teacher named Finn Lanning has agreed to care for and pay for the upkeep of one of his seriously ill students. Now, the student is 13 years old. His name is Damien. His kidneys failed when he was 8. He's been in dialysis ever since, 12 hours a day. And on top of that, he'd been in foster care, but it was too much for many foster families to deal with. So he's going to have to live in a hospital so he could actually get dialysis. But because he was considered homeless, he was initially taken off the kidney transplant list. Well, thanks to Finn, Damien now has a home, is back on the list for a kidney transplant. I spoke with both of them earlier, and I asked Damien, who says he wants to be a chef when he grows up, what he wants to eat once he can get on off the transplant diet, and what he wants to eat when he receives a transplant. I understand that once you get the transplant, that you can actually eat a bigger variety of food because you've been on kind of a restricted diet. What are you looking forward to eating?
I'm a big fan of, like, fast food. So, like, I like 7-Eleven nachos because they're, like, super greasy. That fake plasticky cheese that you can get that nowhere else. So that.
Wait a minute. I love that you're describing plasticky cheese as a good thing.
It's amazing. As long as it tastes good.
Listen, I'm with you. I'm actually a McDonald's person. I like the McDonald's number one meal, the Big Mac, the fries, the Coke.
Yup.
I have not tried the cheesy, the plasticky cheese, though, at 7-Eleven. I got to check that out. Finn, are you a big fan of plasticky cheese at 7-Eleven?
Not so much. I'll give him mine after transplant. He can have all my plastic cheese.
Finn, I mean, did you know you were ready? I mean, obviously, you're a teacher. You've worked with middle school kids. So, you know, you have a love of kids and you deal with kids. But, I mean, this is an incredible commitment. I'm totally boring Damien. I feel bad.
Oh, no, I just didn't sleep that well last night.
It's okay. I'm not offended. Don't worry about it. But yeah, I mean, did you, Finn, did you know you were ready for this challenge?
You know, that's a good question. I spent a long time really thinking about that because, you know, I was compelled immediately to do whatever I could for this kid, but I was also really concerned about making sure that I could follow through with that commitment. There's been a number of people in Damien's life that have, you know, with all the best intentions, attempted to give him some help and weren't able to follow through on that. And I didn't want to be another person that let him down.
And contribute to the GoFundMe page, both tell both Finn and Damien. You can do so at the address on your screen. News continues. Want to hand over to Chris for Cuomo Primetime. Chris.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.